would head your way to Matthew 7. And jumping into our last class together. So thank you for enduring all the way to the end. I really, really appreciate that. If we have time, when we get to the end of class tonight, we'll see how that goes. That depends on you guys and how much you are engaged and participate tonight. But if we have time, I would be interested to know what part of the sermon most challenged you, maybe, or made an impression on you, or something like that, as we've gone through this. So maybe you can have that as a sub-processor in the back of your mind for the next few minutes as we talk about the rest of 7. And as we have time, maybe we'll field a little bit of that. So ponder that as we go through this tonight. Take a peek for now. We're going to pick up at verse 13. That's where we left off. We're going to go through the end of the chapter. And I'm just curious, do you recognize anything starting at verse 13 and going on down through? What's familiar there? I don't know why John is beating his hands together, but evidently he finds that relevant. What do you see, John? So we have the parable. I thought about singing the song, but decided not to. The parable of the wise and foolish builders that comes right at the very end. That it, if for no other reason, because of the kid's song with the cool hand gestures, is memorable to us. What else?
Sheep dressed as wolves.
Oh, yeah, we've got that section in there about the wolves that appear as sheep, deceive us. Yes. What else? It's familiar. The bearing of fruit. Okay. Thank you. What else is familiar? Heard this before.
Broad is the way.
I kind of thought y'all would lead with that since it's the first thing. Yeah, I'm kind of up here going, really? I mean, I would have thought y'all would have said the broad and narrow ways, right? That's something that we've used again and again in teaching and other. When you go through the sermon, you realize how much we extract from it, right? We go through and grab a piece out and work that piece periodically, and that's one of them. Anything else that rings familiar? Yes?
Just an idea that in 21, just because you say, I know God.
And see, I would have thought that would have been the most familiar thing to everyone. 21 to 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord. How many times have y'all heard that referenced in a sermon? Yeah, I was waiting for y'all to say that. Yeah. A whole lot over and over and over again, this idea that to go to heaven, you have to do the will of the Father. That's a very familiar text to us. So really, this latter part of 7, I think, gets pretty heavy use in our preaching and teaching. And so we're in a familiar segment tonight as we wrap this up. The challenge as we work with this familiar section, I think, is to do two things. One, to think about how this fits what has gone on before up to now. And secondly, do these connect with each other in any way? Is this just sort of some random thoughts thrown together? Y'all already know how I feel about that, right? Or is there some connective link between them as Jesus wraps up the sermon? So we're going to work on that tonight, and I'm going to pitch that to you first. So please don't stare back at me blankly when I ask, do you see any common thread running through this section? Any big idea or connection between all of these familiar things we've seen before? Please, thank you for jumping in.
He seems to be building extreme contrasts in every bit of Scripture.
Okay.
And people are going to be astonished at his doctrine, which directly influences how they began, how they
there are these series of contrasts. What are the contrasts we see? I mean, the glaring ones. Yeah, you got two ways, a broad and a narrow way. What else? You have good and bad fruit. Wolves and sheep. Wise and foolish builders. So yeah, there is a contrast working all the way down through here. Yes. Okay. You guys are shaping up a really good sermon here because they all begin with C's, right? Yes. If you could come up with a third C, this is going to be us. You'll hear this coming to a pulpit to you soon. Tell me about choice. The choices actually tie back into the contrast, don't they? There's a broad way and a narrow way contrasted, but the call is to choose a path. And there's a foolish builder and a wise builder. But we're, yeah, but called is the same as choice. Come on. Okay. That does have to be three distinct points because when the last two points are the same, y'all come up and say the sermon was redundant. We know that. So. So tempting, and not going to do it. Anyway, but the choice pertains to, with the two builders, same thing. Which foundation between the two am I going to choose to build on? Good, so we have these contrasts, and behind them or coming out of them, a choice to make. What other connections do you see?
There's also a little bit of the inward-outward.
Ooh. So it doesn't begin with a C,
no.
but it does, well, yeah, character and word. It does tie back to an idea that we can carry all the way, I mean, really, you can carry it all the way back to the Beatitudes, but our launching point really was chapter 5, verse 20, where John told us about the higher righteousness when he taught the class to which we are called, and we've said all the way through, the higher righteousness is not better box checking, it is inwardly being the right kind of person first, so that influences the fruit that we bear on the outside. Good. That ties us back into what we've really been working throughout the sermon. Any other thoughts about that? What's the big idea running through the last part of this? Or what are the connections do you see? Keep working it, man. I'm so pleased. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, he's wrapping it up by actually calling, it's a call to action. I mean, up to this point, you could argue it was always a call to action, but now he's really wrapping it up and saying, now what are you going to do with what I've just told you?
So let me use John's comment as a segue to kind of lay out what I see as the structure here in chapter 7. I told you this, talked a little bit about this last week, that I think between 12 and 13, the sermon transitions. I think you could almost think of verse 12, which is what? What's in verse 12? Randy would be so proud. But what is that? Yeah, the golden rule we suggested last week, really, you could argue, could reflect back over the whole sermon. And it's actually an easy, obedient step. Treat people like you want to be treated. It's an easy way to register how we obey what Jesus is telling us to do in the sermon. And so I almost think that's kind of a capstone, marking the end to what is his teaching or the meat of the sermon. So that when we get to 13 and the roads, I think he's transitioning to, well, we could call it the conclusion of the sermon, but I actually lean toward John's statement. I don't think it's just, okay, I'm going to wrap up now. I think he's really going to say, now here's what I want you to do. Or better yet, here's the choice that you're going to have to make. And I think that's where he's headed here at the end. To help us see that, I want to go back to the very end of the sermon, because I think this becomes important again, and I want to ask you to think with me about this again. What does Matthew say, not Jesus, what does Matthew say at the very end? Do you remember this? You could peek. Yeah, remember that Matthew's summary is not to give commentary on what was said, like, and we all thought that was a great sermon. You know, he didn't say that. Instead, he records for us the response of the crowd. And the response of the crowd was not to comment on, wow, that was a really hard sermon, or that stuff about loving your enemies, I don't know if I can do that, or, boy, you really challenged us today. What did they comment on? Sorry? About the way he said it. They're more impressed with how he said this than they are with what was said. And what was it about the way he said it that was striking with them? Yeah, yeah. So remember we talked about that. The scribes would build their teaching on the traditions of the rabbis. And so if you were a really good scribe back then, you knew what all the old rabbis had said. And when you were making an argument, you could quote this rabbi, you could quote that rabbi, and that gave strength to your case. Jesus doesn't do that at all. Particularly, remember at the end of chapter 5, when he comments on the law and corrects their misunderstandings, what does he say? Remember? Sorry?
But I say.
You've heard that it was said, but I say to you, and again, because of what we believe about Jesus, I said back then that wasn't very striking to us. Well, of course. But to them, this was radical. It was stunning to hear him. It's kind of like, you remember Phil's lesson this morning? When they get into the boat, do you remember what the apostles say about him? Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey his voice? Even these men who know who he is better than anybody, who have seen other miracles and stuff, when they witness that, they're stunned. Who is this? And so think about that as you get to this last little segment at the end of the sermon, because that is, in essence, what Matthew is telling us. People have the same kind of reaction to what he was doing here. Who is this that he would teach in this way? And so, as Jesus comes to the end of the sermon, I think that is where the focus is. The focus is on his authority. And the call to action is going to be what? What do they have to decide? Am I going to listen to this one who speaks with authority or not? Will I hear Jesus or not? So if you want a big idea that starts at verse 13 and runs all the way through the parable of the builders, I think the big idea is this. You have heard what I said to you. The question is, are you going to hear my voice? Will you do what I say? Now, we don't get off the hook here, because I think the sermon really confronts us with the same question. Did you find any of the stuff in the sermon difficult? Like? Thank you. Why couldn't he say, be indifferent to your enemies? Would y'all have had a problem with that? I'm not a violent person, except on 249. And I don't want to get even with people, but sometimes I just kind of want to ignore the people that get under my skin, right? That's not the command. It's a whole new level. You gotta love them, right? Anything else you found difficult? Let your light shine before men in such a way. may see your good works. Glorify your Father who is in heaven. Thank you. Anything else? Come on, guys. Nobody.
Falling for wolves.
I'm sorry?
Falling for wolves.
Tell me about that.
Well, because, I mean, I'm assuming contextually those are people who put on a good show, and yet their fruits will reveal eventually what they're really all about. And so sometimes it's easy to follow a wolf that looks like a sheep because it's so wonderful. And then, to me, that's scary.
It is scary because sometimes we're tempted to listen to the guy who's saying what we want the truth to be and not the guy who's actually telling us the truth. Good. Thank you. Anybody else find something difficult in here? I'm surprised nobody is saying anything about the end of chapter 6. The most prosperous society in human history, and none of us are saying it is really hard not to think too much about stuff and having more and being consumed with that. Maybe that's why we're not bringing it up, because it's the elephant in the room, right? It speaks to us about that. Or nobody struggles with the beginning of chapter 7 about being gracious when we judge other people. I probably got smacked around harder by that than any of the other stuff I read in here. Be gracious in your judgment. Judge other people the way you would want them to judge you. That's tough. So here's a question for me and you. At the last class together, as we walk away, was this some just sort of academic, the mental filing cabinet, maybe he's added a file or two that wasn't there before, just as some academic exercise, or as Jeff is fond of saying, has Jesus messed with your life the last 3 months? And if he has, am I going to hear him? It's the same question that they're confronted with. It's the big idea. He has spoken with authority. What are we going to do with it? Going to hear him. Now, what he does is he works three examples to illustrate his point vividly. So let's walk through them together. Beginning with that familiar section, look at 7:13. Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. So here, what is the choice he says we have to make? Because y'all said it's about a choice. It's a choice between two contrasting options. What's the choice?
Go the way everyone else is going, or go the right way?
It's a road. What's a road symbolize? Okay, what does it symbolize, though?
Life.
The road symbolizes the life we choose to live. And we often use that figure of we're taking a path, right? We're walking a certain road. In fact, did you catch it in Phil's sermon this morning? He talked about that. The very beginning of his lesson, he said, it's an idea that actually runs all the way through the scripture. And I grabbed my iPad and I wrote that down. I said, I use that in my class tonight. We're talking about another place where they're the roads. It's all the way through the Proverbs, the way of the right wise man and the way of the fool. So all the way through scripture, this idea that there are two roads that lay in front of us, two contrasting roads, and we have to make a choice. That's the call to action, to choose between the two roads. Tell me what needs to be said about the roads. Let's explore them a little bit. Why do you think one's easy and one's hard? What is it in the language that causes you to say, oh, by the way, I agree. So, so I think the fact that it is described as being broad is symbolic, and the access to it is wide, symbolizes that it's easy to get on. And, oh, I need to be careful here. appears to be easier to travel. That's why I wrote easy and hard up here, because we're going to get totally messed up on this when we start working on it, right? But the appearance from the outside is, it is the easier way to get on, the easier way to travel. Yes, ma'am. Yes. So one of the things about the Broadway is that most other people go that way. And why is that important? That most other people go that way.
Some don't.
But why is it alluring to us that most other people are going this way? What's alluring about that? It feels that when others are affirming us, yes, this is the right thing. By the way, what is it that our homosexual and transgender friends want from us? Affirm that my path is right. Yes. Tell me that it's okay the way that I'm going. And so I think there's a human hunger for that, for others to give me their approval and tell me that it's right. Stott, in his books, excellent book, Christian Counterculture, book on the Sermon on the Mount, describes this as the road of tolerance and permissiveness with no boundaries, no curbs. Just kind of live like you want, right? And I think, at least for a season, that feels like the better way to go. Tell me about the other way. How is it described? Sorry?
Narrow.
Harder to access, more narrow. This one does have boundaries and rules and limitations set by. Yes. Yeah, so I'm not just free to get in the morning and decide to do what I want to do. In fact, that is what separates you and I fundamentally from the world. We don't get ever up every day and just kind of go do what we want to do. All the time, what hangs over us is this what God wants? Am I doing what would please and honor Him? So there are boundaries and curbs that narrows in the path that we're supposed to follow. Does that make it more difficult? Yeah, I know. It's a goofy question, isn't it? So tell me, does it? Well, let's work it both ways. And what way is it more difficult to go this way? I'm not going the way that everyone else is going, right? That's what I love about Stott's book, Counter Culture. It's people paddling upstream. Have you ever paddled upstream? So I've done some canoeing with my wife. Not a lot, because I discovered when I got in the boat with her on the lake that she expected me to do all the rowing. And so I have tried to paddle upstream. It's a lot harder way to go, and that's what we're doing. We're going counter to the culture. Is it okay that I threw you in the bus on that? Okay. She said yes, John. Anyway, I just point out she didn't deny that that was true. Just putting that on the record right there. What else is more difficult about that? Okay, reason and accountability. I answer to someone for the choices I'm making. Yes, sir.
As you said, in cases, it sounds like it's even hard to locate.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes,
you got to find your way onto this road. It isn't just that easy access like the other path. Yeah?
You've got to make a lot of decisions.
Decisions to be made.
The easy way, you're just like, hey, what do you want to do? How about you want to do?
You can just float along. By the way, I think our culture does that a lot. I think that's why we're so enamored with polls and polling data. You know, what is it? What does everybody else think about this? And that's where we're going to go too. We kind of just get swept up in whatever is current with the culture. Yes, ma'am.
It's easier to fall off America.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
You've got a broader path. It doesn't matter if you're.
Doesn't really matter what you do.
You got a narrow one. You fall off.
Okay. Did I hear a voice over here? Somebody want to?
I think it's. I
you're not. I mean, so...
It's scary when you get down to verses 21 to 23.
Because we all think we're on the right side, but maybe we're not. So I think that makes it even more difficult because a lot of people think they're on the narrow path.
Can be deceived about it.
Deceived about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. That's getting us into those two voices we'll get to in just a minute. Let me avoid saying more until we get there. So I want to ask you a question that to me is really important. Is the broad way really the easier way to go?
No, because later in Matthew, he says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
Yeah, I think we're dealing with appearances here. And we don't even get to the destination yet. I think it appears to be the easier way to go, but the problem with the broad path that makes it the harder way to go is what? Well, we'll get to the hold that one.
Do lemmings think that they're going the easy path? Yeah, and then what happens? They fall off the cliff.
The problem with this path is sin, right? And inevitably, folks, whether you believe in sin or not, whether you believe sin will hurt you or not, it will. It will destroy us. And so eventually that path has potholes. There's misery that lies on it. And by the same token, the narrow way that seems harder to travel winds up being the better way because we're spared, not all from all grief and suffering in life, but certainly all the grief and suffering that comes with the choice in sin. We wind up being spared from that. And so ultimately, God is seeking our good by putting us on the narrow way. Same thing is true with our children. We make rules with our children. You cannot go play in the street, which seemed totally unfair with this huge open piece of concrete out in front of the house that I could play on, right? And so it's hard not to do that, but we know in reality it's better because we're protecting them. That's what God does for us. That's what God's fences are all about. They're all about protecting us. And then there's the added element that he gets to in Matthew, in verses 13 and 14, of the destination. Tell me about that. Yeah, so remember, this is a contrast. We've talked about that. And so ultimately, choosing the path is not just the choice between the broad and the narrow and the easy and the hard. It's between destruction and life, right? Both of the roads are going somewhere. They both have a destination. One is obviously good. One is obviously bad. That's what I love about our decision. It really isn't a hard decision at all, is it? Not when you stop and realize the long-term picture here. Actually, it becomes an easy choice to make. Yes, sir?
Well, and it's not really about the path. It's about the destination. He says, enter through the narrow gate. And then he talks about the path. But it requires like your total attention of the gate itself, not necessarily.
Get on that path.
Right.
Get on that path. Stay on that path. Right. All the way till you get to the end. And so, big picture of the conclusion here of the sermon, let's tie this into what Jesus is working at the end of Matthew 7. How does this fit? What is he saying with the two roads? What are the two roads ultimately? Did that question throw you? It's a choice between what? Sorry? In the end, is a choice between heaven and hell? Okay, so here's what I want you to see. The two roads ask the same question that's working through this whole section. Jesus is saying, are you going to hear me? The narrow way that leads to life is the life where a person hears Jesus and walks the path he calls us to. You see how underneath it is the same question? Am I going to hear Jesus? Those traveling the broad way that are, as John said, lemmings going off the cliff, are people who are not listening to Jesus because Jesus would be calling to his people and saying, don't go that way. That's why they end up off the cliff. That's why they end up with destruction. The underlying question is, are we going to hear his voice? That makes sense? Y'all see that? That's tying together this whole thought here at the end of the letter. All right, beginning in verse 15, I want to look at 15 through 23. Tell me what you see. What's going on here? Chapter 7, 15 through 23. I'll read it. Beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, and a bad tree bears bad fruit. Good tree cannot produce bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then you will know them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Who does the will of my Father will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles. And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. What do you see? Okay, so we have these false prophets. So we have this other voice out there. Tell me about these false prophets.
They're saying all the right stuff.
Are they?
Well, to your ears. I mean, they're saying the right stuff is ruling your way from Christ. It's just good enough to get away with.
They look like, but they're really... Okay, does that scare y'all a little bit? David, you were talking about this a minute ago, and I really want to come back and dwell on that point for a minute. I think we imagine that false teachers are always obvious to us. Is that true? Often they're cloaked in the robe of religion, and often they have really compelling speech, which makes them
attractive
and more dangerous. They're easy to hear. And so he really wants us to notice here the danger, that this is what you were saying, the danger of being deceived because they look and sound really good. Maybe they, I have this great book from a guy named Tony Campolo, and the title of the book is, We've Confronted the Enemy and He's Partially Right. You know, it might be the guy you're listening to. Not everything he says is wrong. Maybe some of the things he says are true. Go ahead.
It's like a complex true and false question. You get all these things that are stated in the paragraph, and there's one thing wrong.
That isn't right.
Isn't right, and you're thinking, well, all these other things are right. Maybe that one is two, and then you say, that's true. That's what happened. That's what I mean when it says they sound good.
So talk to me a little bit about how we're supposed to distinguish that. Because this is serious business. Listening to the wrong voice is serious business. If there are some wolves out there that look like sheep and sound like they're right, how do I know?
Well, he gives the answer. You go back to the will of God every time, and you'll get back on the narrow way. That's what their fruits of their labor, which will be negative ultimately. And then to test what they're saying, you're going to see that which we're responsible for, which is part of the narrow way, you're going to see how it either conflicts or is in harmony with what God has told us.
Yeah, so notice, he says in verse 16, after warning us about their deceptive nature, he says, you will know them by their fruits. And then he goes on to give, an extensive illustration of how a good tree cannot bear bad fruit and so on and so forth. And then he says again in verse 20, you will know them by their fruits. So I want to unpack that idea a little bit. David has tapped into part of it, and maybe even the more important part, and that is their message can be measured by a standard. By the way, that necessarily implies that truth is absolute. Such a thing does exist. Absolute truth is knowable, and it's knowable to me and you so that we can measure what we hear and know what is right. So there's a message piece to this that can be tested. Is that the only kind of fruit that a false teacher will bear, though? That would enable us to know they're not to be trusted? Anything other than their message?
There's always the do as I say, not as I do, accountable to the Pharisees.
So one of the ways that you can judge a false teacher is by his conduct and his life, right? Or maybe what he does behind closed doors that winds up coming into the light, right? What does his character look like? Because frankly, there are some people who are really compelling speakers, even wearing the cloak of religion. And then in reality, in their conduct, they are ungodly and unholy. And so there's conflict between what they claim to be true and how they claim to live their lives. So I think that life is an example of that. Think of any other fruits that we can look at?
Well, extrapolating on that, if I may, a specific of that might be occasionally look at their families, look at their wives, husband, you know, whatever, and notice how those people are behaving or reacting. And sometimes you can tell those are a kind of fruit, I believe. And so when you look at that and everything's chaotic and horrible and a mess, then
let me hijack your point and run even further with it. May I do that, please? I actually wrote down in my notes, what is the impact of his life and message on the people around him, even the people that he teaches? If he's teaching truth, obviously you can't control people, but if a guy's teaching truth, what kind of impact should that have on the people that hear him and that he influences? It should help them also to know truth and to obey truth. And sometimes you can look at how what kind of impact someone is having on others who hear him, and that might tell us something about.
Like what Troy was saying, even though they, I think they can have good impact on others and they can say the truth, still doesn't mean they're not wolves.
That's exactly right. And so
you have to be wise to, they're going to show themselves, and you just have to be wise enough to pick up on what they're showing. And that's hard.
Well, so where does the first admonition, verse 15, gives us? What does that mean? So will y'all do me a favor? And I mean this as sincerely as I can. I mean, when y'all listen to me, whether it's in this class or out there in the pulpit, will y'all really be discerning about what I say to you? And be thoughtful about that message, and even maybe challenge me sometimes if you think something isn't quite line up with what Christ says, because our allegiance is not to any man. Our allegiance is to Jesus. So if it's me or Jeff or Randy or Hunter, be a little easier on Hunter, but if there's something we're saying up there that doesn't line up, we need to have a conversation about that, because there is always the danger that I may be hearing a voice that is directing me to the wrong path. Now, look at 21 to 23. Why is it so vital that I be able to discern? Verses 21 to 23 are the most scary verses to me in the whole Bible. Because these are not condemning people who were immoral and wicked. What kind of people are being talked to in verses 21 to 23?
People thought that they were doing it right.
Religious people who called him Lord and were involved in good spiritual works. What was the problem? What do you say in 23? They practiced what? I don't know what they were doing religiously, but I do know that it didn't line up with the law, and in the end they're told to depart. So man, just put a big exclamation point right there. It is possible to be sincerely deceived if we are not discerning. I really think we need to ponder that. By the way, real quick, I want to back up to 7. By the way, you're going to be hearing, I'm just cooking this sermon on chapter 7, verses 7 through 11. I mean, that really stirred me up last week. So y'all could skip that Sunday morning. I'll let you know when it's coming. But I'm going to preach on that. Let me just remind you of Jesus' admonition. Listen, don't be freaked out about this. Ask me. And so I think it's a good thing to pray regularly in our prayers. Lord, be sure, help me be sure that I am hearing and understanding what is true. Help me be discerning about what I take in, what I read, who I listen to, and help me discern what is true and what is not true. That needs to be a constant prayer we lift to the Lord, that we will know what His path is and that we will stay on this path. Who had a comment about that? David, let me go David first.
Sincerely trying to do the will of God but is just plain wrong. It seems to me like he's talking about people who are doing this, but and they may be doing the right thing, but in the end their inner hearts are working iniquity. So to me it's a subtle difference. Maybe so.
I certainly would not want to eliminate that as a possibility, that there are hard issues there. Because listen, we've already learned from the sermon that you can be giving to the poor, right? And doing it to be seen of men. And you can be praying to be seen of men. So I would certainly not divorce that as a possibility here. The only thing that I would say is he does begin in 21 with not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord. So it isn't enough to just say that I believe that. And it isn't even enough to say I do religious stuff. Because candidly, even the Pharisees believed in Jehovah and did religious stuff, right? So maybe the inward outward is a piece of all of that. But I do think it is possible to religiously be sincerely deceived and maybe even be a good person in your heart. Well, maybe in a lot of ways. But I think that devotion to truth really underlies all that. Maybe that's a, here, I'm going to help you with the inward. That's the inward part that may be missing. I'm into religious stuff, but am I devoted to truth, to knowing what truth is and doing that?
Right, and if you're wrong, if you are seeking truth, if you're knocking on the door, he's going to answer you.
Oh, I believe that.
So it's a little bit more...
Yeah, God's not playing a shell game with us, folks. Right. God wants us to know and to believe, and I think if we seek, what did he say? You will find. I do. I firmly believe that. Yeah, John.
That's not who Jesus is talking to. He's talking to Jews who, by and large, most of whom, you know, have some desire to do what is right. And I think he moves even from, most of this is about the false prophets, but he's easily saying, you can fall into this, and you can fall under the control of this person, and you can be one of the people I'm telling you, Lord, Lord. And I think one of the issues is we have this tendency to look outward instead of looking inward, even though, you know,
it's someone else's problem.
Right. Well, what happens in Acts 20? I mean, it's from among yourselves.
From among your own selves.
That wolves are going to come. I mean, we have a tendency to be too much looking outward and not enough looking inward to say, are we all... Most importantly, am I producing the fruit that shows it's about trying to follow Jesus as opposed to, I mean, Jill was pointing out, maybe the problem with these people is we did this. Well, they had an eye problem.
Maybe.
You know, it wasn't about we did this for you or we did this because you told us to do this. We did this. I mean, I don't think we look nearly enough at ourselves, is this talking about me?
And isn't that the whole point about don't judge at the beginning of chapter 7? Now that you know these things, don't be so filled up with self-righteousness that you're harsh in your judgment of other people, but be generous and merciful and gracious in your judgment. I think that ties in to the idea that you're saying there. Yeah, I think the sermon is meant to make us look at ourselves. I think what we're seeing here is a warning about one of the dangers is, and that is you can be You can be saying Jesus is Lord, and you could even be doing some religious love stuff. The question is, are you following the law that the Lord gave? Am I doing that too? So I think it is speaking to us. I do think we need to be careful not to always look out and not look in. There are dangers out there we need to be aware of, but there are also dangers in here too, right? Okay? So I think the choice in this section, 15 through 23, is a choice between the two voices. There are voices that will pull us toward that narrow way, and there are voices that will pull us to the broad way. And so here's our responsibility. Recognize that danger exists. Recognize this is serious business, and beware. Be discerning. Tell you what, folks, we just got to take our faith more seriously. More thoughtful, more studious, more careful. And I'm going to say it again, and I sincerely mean this. Even when it comes to what you hear in this church, by the guys that I hope you love, you need to be discerning, even about us, to make sure what we're telling you is the truth. All right, anybody want to weigh in on that before we move on? Because what I want to do next is sing the wise man song. I really don't want to do that. So one more segment here, 24 to 27, and I'll read this. Tell me what you hear. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against the house, yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. What do you hear? So I think it's here in the parable that Jesus now says plainly what he has said with the other illustrations. There are two roads to choose. Hear me and travel the narrow way, right? There are two voices you might hear. Hear me and not the voice of the false teacher. And beware, be sensitive so that you can discern between the two. And now he just says it plainly. First of all, let's work through the parable. Two men build, in the parable, houses. What do those symbolize? By the way, who are the two men? Us. We're all building. Not houses. Lives. Yes, again, back to that, the roads. It's plotting a journey. It's building a life, right? One man, the wise man, how does he build his house? What does he do?
Finds the foundation.
Okay, but the application to us, what does he do? Who is this man? He's the one who acts on the words of Jesus. The foolish man who builds on the sand hears and does not act. Do you see it? This is ultimately where he's driving in the sermon. You've heard what I've had to say. I proclaim to you the gospel of the kingdom, but there's still a question to be answered. Will you do what I said? Or will you not do what I said? Now, one more thing in this story before we run out of time. I may need an extra minute or two from you. He talks about this thing that will tell which house is solid. What's going to tell the difference? The storms are going to come. I got to tell you, I did some work on this text a couple of years ago. I really struggled with the storm. What do you think the storm symbolizes? Life. What about life? Bad stuff that happens in life. By the way, will that test your foundation? It will.
The good stuff will too. Yeah. When we start looking, you mentioned earlier, we talked about the end of chapter 6 and then anxiety, we're a blessed nation. I mean, prosperity can be in ways your foundation.
Yeah. That is traditionally the way I've understood the storm was the trial of lives. And I think that still may be what he is saying. But go back up to the two roads. destruction and life. And y'all said it, heaven and hell. And then what happens to the unfruitful branches? Cast into the fire. That sounds like what? And so now we get to this storm that will show every man's foundation for what it really is. What's the other possibility? Yeah. The other storm that he may have in mind here is the storm of final judgment, when every man's build is exposed for what it really is. The point Jesus is making is that day is coming. And when it does, there will be two categories of people. Those who listen to me and did what I said, and those who don't. And so at the end of the day, folks, that is the call of the sermon. It really isn't about what's in the sermon. It's about who said it. And do we believe that it is the Son of God who said it to us? Because if it isn't, I don't want to love my enemies. But if it is, what's the obligation? I got to do what he said. So ponder that as you look back and ponder the sermon. I've enjoyed the class. Thank you for the time together.